You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, tributes are pouring in for Venezuelan leader Hugo Chavez, but also some sharp critiques of his time in power. We take a spin around the globe to hear how he's being remembered.
The scenes are pretty dramatic. There are women crying, holding images of the president, screaming his name. There is the mourning and people are very sad.
It sounds straight out of Moses and the Ten Commandments, but Israelis are preparing to do battle with a swarm of locusts from Egypt. And South Korea is on a buying frenzy for gold. We find out why bars of this precious metal are on central banks' shopping lists.
If you look at central bank holdings as a whole, they went up significantly last year, about 17%, with net purchasing of 535 tons, which was a record since the 1960s.
Car junkies are in paradise at the Geneva Motor Show. We'll tell you about the new models that are having everyone talking and where the trade is headed. All that, plus we'll find out what makes the best cup of coffee and we play some music too, all to come in the next hour on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the latest headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Jordan is feeling the strain as official figures revealed over a million Syrians have now registered as refugees in neighbouring countries outside Syria. Jordan maintains an open border policy with Syria and has taken in over 400,000 refugees since the start of the conflict almost 2 years ago. Most of these refugees reside in the Zaatar refugee camp. Andrew Harper, UNHCR's representative to Jordan, says the number of refugees is increasing at a rapid rate.
Well, we think there's probably about 100,000 Syrians who are now in Zaatari, although the number is often open to dispute because people come in and go out of the camps. What we do know is that the Jordanian government saying there's 420,000 Syrians who have now entered the country. That's basically 100,000 more than that were here about a month ago.
Kenyan police have today said they found ballot papers dumped in some parts of the capital city, Nairobi. Police said the ballot papers were found in Nairobi's northern suburb of Ruaka, a stronghold of the presidential candidate Uhuru Kenyatta, after being tipped off of a suspicious plastic bag left near a communal rubbish dump. Deputy Prime Minister Uhuru Kenyatta has kept an early lead since poll results started trickling in, but some strongholds for his rival, Prime Minister Raila Odinga, have yet to declare their results. A UNICEF report has today said that Palestinian children detained by the Israeli military are subject to widespread systematic ill-treatment that violates international law. The United Nations Children Fund estimated that 700 Palestinian children, aged between 12 to 17, most of them boys, are arrested, interrogated and detained by the Israeli military, police and security agents every year in the occupied West Bank. Jean Goff, the UNICEF special representative, said they had identified some examples of practices that amount to cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment.
We identify a pattern of ill-treatment when children are in military custody. And what we see is that this happens in the first 48 hours. So that's the process that we need more changes to happen. Imagine a child sitting in front of an interrogator without sleeping. So that's very hard on the child. And that's difficult for him. So this is where we want to make the changes to make sure that that doesn't happen.
The US Capitol shut down today ahead of a predicted snowstorm that already has blanketed the Midwest, leaving thousands without power and forcing hundreds of flights to be cancelled. The government already hit by an $85 billion in overall budget cuts that took effect last Friday ordered 375,000 federal workers in the Washington area to stay at home. Meanwhile, the United States has warned Iran that it faces further international isolation if it fails to address United Nations nuclear watchdog concerns about its atomic activities. The US envoy, Joseph McManus, accused Iran of provocative actions, particularly its installation of advanced centrifuges that would enable it to speed up its uranium enrichment work.
The time for action by Iran is now. There is no lack of clarity on what steps Iran has to take. There is no debate over requirements that it has to meet. And Iran has the capability and the ability to respond to the concerns that it has heard raised by the Board of Governors over the past 10 years. Responsibility to respond to that concern lies directly with the government of Iran.
And finally, a German travel agency is selling tickets to 88 astronomy fanatics to give them a flight and a close-up view of one of two rare comets expected to pass the Earth this year. Eclipse Travel is organising the flight on the 16th of March as comet Pan-STARRS passes through the solar system 100 million miles from Earth. And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. It's 18.06 here in London, which means it's 10.06 in Los Angeles and 19.06 in Budapest. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
Now, Venezuelans are mourning the death of their leader and the socialist poster boy, Hugo Chavez. The 58-year-old died Monday after a two-year fight against cancer. Chavez's body is lying in state and will remain there for several days. Anyway you look at it, Chavez was an immensely influential figure, whether you agreed with his politics or not. To get a sense of how the international community is reacting to news of his death, it's time to take a trip around the globe and check in with our network of correspondents. We'll head to Washington to speak to Sasha Isenberg. We'll head to Caracas to speak to Irene Caselli. But we're going to start in Madrid with Liam Aldus. Liam, thank you very much for joining us. There are two words which seem to sum up the whole relationship between Spain and Venezuela. And that was when King Juan Carlos told Hugo Chavez, shut up. Did things get better after that?
Well, he didn't shut up. We just should put that on the record. I don't think Chavez would ever listen to anyone if they told him to shut up. But yeah, it does sum up the relationship. It's been quite a testy relationship officially, mainly because of the appropriation of the Spanish companies over the whole tenure of Chavez's reign, I guess. If we want to talk about the reaction here to his death, it's been a lot different to that of Venezuela, where it's been high drama on the streets, lots of emotion. I think it's been a lot more subdued here on the streets because the Venezuelan community is quite big in Madrid. There's quite a lot of Venezuelans, and most of them are here, they say, because of Chavez. They've actually left the country because of his policies in search of work and opportunity. So a lot of them aren't showing signs of celebrating his death because that would just be tasteless. They're saying that they're relieved and they're looking forward to the future and whether this will be a new beginning for Venezuela. But a lot of them are quite nervous and anxious to see what will happen.
Now, I know you've done an interview with the editor of El País for us in the coming weeks. And they also had a recent run-in because they printed a picture of Hugo Chavez, which turned out not to be a picture of him on his deathbed. How has that newspaper today covered the news?
They've been checking their sources a lot more today, but they've done quite a range of stories talking about the whole history of the relationship and how Chavez has really reshaped Venezuela. And they've actually got quite a difficult job covering Venezuela because they have a very strained relationship with the Venezuelan government, particularly after this the recent episode with the photo that turned out not to be true. But their coverage has been front page coverage, and particularly on their website, because they are really pitching themselves as the global newspaper in Spanish. So they're really trying to cover it for all of Latin America, and they've got really extended coverage.
And just quickly, do you think that the Spanish central government will be hoping that it can rebuild some ties now with Venezuela and perhaps have a clean slate again?
I'm sure they'll try, but not many people are hopeful. If you look at Nicolas Maduro, and he's basically, I think he's going to change his the policy agenda very much, but I'm sure they'll be trying. There's always been a strained relationship, but I think business will really try. They're always trying to woo the Venezuelan leadership when they were here. When Chavez was last in Madrid, the head of Repsol, the big Spanish oil giant, actually took Chavez around, and I would have loved to know what they talked about, but there is a very concerted effort to really woo the Venezuelan leadership. They don't want to lose any more companies.
Liam, great to speak to you as always. That was Liam Aldous, who's our man in Madrid. Now we're going to head over to Caracas, where earlier I spoke to the journalist Irene Caselli.
Well, right now, most channels are actually broadcasting live from the procession that is crossing through Caracas, carrying the coffin of Mr. Chavez from the hospital where he died to the military chapel where the funeral will start from. And the scenes are pretty dramatic. There are women crying, holding images of the president, screaming his name. There is the mourning, and people are very sad. Last night when the news was announced, I was out in the streets, and people were telling me about how the president felt like a father figure to them, and they felt that they'd lost a father, that they were part of one big family, and that for the first time they were feeling proud of being Venezuelan.
And tell me, that there's obviously a strong opposition even today in Venezuela, and the press that may be more sympathetic to them, are they trying to tell a different story, or are they just giving in and also kind of lauding the man today?
Well, right now there is a pretty somber mood everywhere. Even opposition figures, even critics are calling for national unity. Some people have been tweeting about, you know, the bad sides of Mr. Chavez. But at the same time, out in the streets again today, I was speaking to people who weren't voters of Mr. Chavez. One man told me he would have never voted for the late president, but at the same time, he had to recognize that he'd changed completely the history of the country, and that one could talk of a Venezuela before Mr. Chavez and a different Venezuela after Mr. Chavez.
And again, is there a feeling that there's going to be a seamless transition to a new government?
It's very likely that Nicolas Maduro, the vice president, who was picked by Mr. Chavez to be his preferred successor, it's very likely that Maduro will win in the elections that are called, that will be called for next week, and that will have to be held within 30 days. I don't think we'll see many surprises in that sense. He will be running against opposition leader Enrique Capriles, most likely. Capriles lost against Chavez in October by 11 points, and it's unlikely that, especially in such an emotional moment, people will change their mind about the socialist revolution that Mr. Chavez has been carrying all these years.
Well, that was me speaking a little bit earlier to the journalist Irene Caselli, who is currently in Caracas. We're now going to go over to Washington, D.C., where we're going to speak to our correspondent in the city, Sasha Issenberg. Sasha, thank you very much for coming on. The relationship between the U.S. and Venezuela has, let's be fair, been terrible. What's been the reaction from Washington and from the press in the U.S.?
Among American politicians, I think that there's been something that starts to glee on the sort of far right of the political spectrum to, a sort of cautious welcoming of, you know, what a lot of people have sort of been calling, the opportunity for a new chapter that you get among more sort of cautious politicians in the center. A press conference has been pretty exhaustive in the last 18 hours. I mean, not exhaustive, but a lot of attention on American cable, which doesn't do a whole lot of foreign coverage anyway. On from Caracas and particularly on obviously Spanish language television. The two networks, Univision and Telemundo, are treating this obviously as a major story in the region from which most of their audience comes.
Obviously, Chavez managed to kind of change the way that the U.S.'s links with other countries in the region operated. He's changed, I think, that forever, don't you think? Do you think the Americans now have to reassess post-Chavez how they engage with Latin America?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, this was the thing that, after a little bit of the sort of post-Cold War lull, I think returned the United States to understanding the sort of ideological complexities of being in the Americas and the idea that there were sort of entangling alliances to be had there. And so I think one of the reasons that that sort of less impulsive of American politicians have been cautious in being specific and sort of rooting for outcomes in Venezuela, they know how sort of toxic a seal of approval from Washington can be for domestic politicians in a country like Venezuela and elsewhere in the region. And so I think that there's a sense that, you know, the United States can only do so much to sort of goad outcomes there and often could provoke a backlash if it seems to be sort of trying to put a finger on the scale one way or the other.
Do you think this is also interesting case to watch what happens between Washington and Havana as well? Because obviously Hugo Chavez was very keen to look after the Castros, his mentors, the people he admired most for bringing the socialist revolution to the region in the first place. But that kind of stopped often the feeling that Washington could do anything about its relationship with Havana. Do you think we may see some more re-engagement there as well?
Yeah, I mean, there have been small movements from the Obama administration to open up some new relationships, to loosen some of the restrictions on U.S. interactions with Cuba, especially for families going back and forth to visit relatives. And Kerry, the new Secretary to John Kerry, has been fairly forceful in the Senate in wanting to loosen some restrictions, and there are hints that the State Department has sort of begun a review of some further areas where, even within the confines of the embargo, they can open up greater ties between the countries. So it'll be interesting to see whether that ends up being sort of caught in whatever complexities come out of the U.S. relationship with the new regime in Caracas. But I think it's you can easily see that as something that, especially in a second term, Obama, who did surprisingly well among younger Cuban Americans in his reelection, would see an opportunity to leave a sort of foreign policy legacy.
Sasha, thank you very much for joining us. That's Sasha Isenberg, who's our man in Washington, D.C. And we're going to be looking at Locus next, because they're on the move in Israel.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture, and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the time shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
The Entrepreneurs is a show about inspiring startups, innovative business models, and smart CEOs. It's about good ideas and the people with the business acumen to make them into the brands of tomorrow.
Character, your vision, your courage, all these are necessary to become a leader.
In the latest edition, we seek out the entrepreneurs with an ethical, social lilt. We profile the businessmen and women using the capitalist model for good. We'll find out about a historic refuge in London, Soho, which assists some of the city's dispossessed, and its plans to turn its charity HQ into a sumptuous private members club. And we'll quiz the authors of two new books on the ethical business model about their views.
The social entrepreneurs who I've come across, who are the really impressive ones, have seen that it's important to make some kind of profit in order to make your business sustainable.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. An invasion of locusts in Egypt centuries ago was the eighth plague according to the Book of Exodus, something Moses had hoped would free the Israelites from the rule of the Pharaoh. The 10 plagues may have set Moses and his people free those many years ago, but now Egypt may have the last laugh, according to some. tens of thousands of locusts, if not millions, which resemble dark clouds in the air, have been making their way from Egypt to Israel just weeks before the Jewish holiday of Passover. Despite attempts by the government to stop the advance of the locusts, they're threatening to destroy hundreds of acres of crops. Joining me now on the line from Jerusalem is Monocle's correspondent there, Joseph Dana, who is hopefully well clear of the plague, well, of all those locusts. Anyway, Joseph, thank you for joining us. Are you surrounded by chirping critters at the moment?
Well, we are not at the moment in Jerusalem. At least they're not flying around in the air. They're actually kind of flying around on the plates of some of Jerusalem's better restaurants, and it's kind of creating a very interesting kind of food sensation, as it were. But so far, these swarms of locusts are still in the southern part of Israel near the Egyptian border.
Now, the numbers actually I see now have been put at 30 million of them kind of heading your way. Obviously, I presume concern amongst farmers about the devastation they may cause.
Absolutely. The Israelis have employed quite advanced technology to combat these locusts. As soon as they approach the Egyptian-Israeli border, they sent up a number of reconnaissance planes, which are actually used often in Gaza vis-a-vis the Hamas-Israeli relationship there. And they've been, you know, employing and kind of covering large areas of crops with pesticides and whatnot. And so far, it looks like the winds are actually going to be in the Israelis' favor, and they're going to kind of push these locusts out towards the Red Sea and maybe even to Saudi Arabia. And so it doesn't look like they're actually going to get into the heart of Israeli territory, you know, Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and these cities.
Now, we joke about it, but it is extraordinary how even the arrival of an insect can become a slightly political battle. I see that many Twitter users in Egypt have been saying that this is the Muslim Brotherhood curse being visited on Israel.
Absolutely, and this has definitely been echoed in the Israeli kind of Twitter sphere and in the Israeli press as well. But there actually have been some quite concrete, you know, kind of manifestations of these locusts in terms of the crops in Gaza have been decimated by some accounts because the Hamas leadership there doesn't have the pesticides that the Israelis do, or they can't get them into the territory. And so the politics does actually play out in terms of how people are reacting to these, you know, incredible swarms of upwards of 30 million locusts. It's really quite breathtaking to see the pictures of it.
And is there some kind of feeling in Israel that the Egyptians, if not Hamas, should have done something to stop the locusts before they came their way?
Well, we haven't seen anything like that. But it, you know, it's funny because it's such a, you know, these locusts, you know, harkens back to this kind of biblical imagery of ancient Israel and its kind of tribulations with the Egyptians and whatnot. And right now, you know, the situation in the Middle East is a bit volatile, and so people are kind of, at least some of the more superstitious people, are looking at this as a kind of Elizabethan echo, as it were, you know, kind of the earth is responding to the grave kind of political transitions that are unfolding all over the Middle East, the greater Middle East.
And Joseph, finally, just tell me, are there any good local recipes for eating them?
Well, apparently, Jews from Yemen, Yemenite Jews, have some very excellent recipes for baking them. And there's a real food trend inside of Israeli society that goes to kind of biblical foods that are native to Israel. And so the fact that 30 million locusts have now kind of descended on Israeli territory is making a lot of people in the food community quite, you know, excited that there's such an ample supply. And in fact, the Israeli newspapers are full of recipes for locusts to celebrate the upcoming Passover holiday. So it's really quite funny indeed to see how this is you know, unfolding in Israeli society.
Well, I think I'm going to stick with the hummus, but perhaps we could get you to kind of cook some up and give us a report tomorrow on how delicious or not they are. Joseph, thank you very much for joining us. That's Joseph Dana, who's our man in Jerusalem. Stay safe, Joseph. Now, welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Our focus turns now to high school basketball teams in America, where players and coaches shoot for the next level, the college game, and perhaps even the pros after that. Each year, as the school season winds down, high school teams are ranked by basketball experts who follow the very best squads. Those upper echelons are rarely dominated by white kids from public schools in small towns in the Midwest. But that is exactly what's happened this season, and the unlikely tale of the Lone Peak Knights, young Mormons from the mountains of Utah, should be enjoyed while that's still possible, i.e. before it gets turned into a soppy film, almost certainly starring Robin Williams as the coach. James Nelson sent this report.
The Lone Peak Wilderness area in the Uinta Cache National Forest is a breathtaking collection of forest, animals, soaring mountains, fresh water, beauty in every direction. Tourists from everywhere in the world come to see it year-round. And now, something more in the shadow of these mountains, just down the road. Lone Peak High School, a fitting name for the best boys high school basketball team in all of America. The Lone Peak Knights, a high school team of gangly, Ichabod Crane-looking, mostly Mormon, clean-cut basketball players. Their coach is Quincy Lewis.
You know, it's unique, you know, because, you know, we walk in there and they look at us and, you know, we're not formidable, let's just say that. We got one kid who's 6'10 that looks like he can maybe play a little bit, and the rest of the guys look like they should be sitting in the stands rooting for everybody, eating some popcorn. But, you know, the rest of us, you know, we don't look like a whole lot. And, you know, it's a natural thing for any kid. You know, you're going to evaluate the guy that you're looking down at the other end of the court, and you say, oh, geez, what do they look like? And, you know, I think our guys, we laugh at ourselves. We know we look like a bunch of skinny guys who can't play. We know that, you know, but we enjoy competing, though.
At Lone Peak High School, the trophy case is full of previous season successes, and hallway signs encourage the Lone Peak players to keep it going. Teachers like JoLynn Wright say in the classroom, players like TJ Hawes, one of the best players in the country, are a positive influence.
Their most important goal is to succeed as a team, not as an individual.
In the classroom, do they want special attention? Do they think they need accolades that should come from the court into the class setting? Not so?
Oh, heavens no. In fact, as TJ gets embarrassed when you make a big deal out of it. They want to win, but to be honest, I think TJ would rather win in life and be a good human being, and I've seen him do so. I've seen him do the small things that matter in life and defend the little person and defend the people that struggle, not make a big deal out of anything. He's incredibly humble.
Sad dad, bad hat. Dad is sad, very, very sad. We had a bad day. What a day dad had. Thing.
Staying humble seems to be a team motto, but players like Connor Toulson admit it's not always easy.
He's a good coach. Like, he knows what he's doing.
Met him, nice guy.
Yeah, he's a good guy. And so he teaches us not only about basketball, but life, like everything, like being on time, we're never late for stuff, just all the things in life that you need to learn.
Do you still maintain that sense of being humble as an individual and as a team, given the success?
Yeah, we try to, but it's not easy sometimes, but we try to stay as humble as we can, stay as grounded as we can.
Connor's just teasing him. Connor likes to tease.
Yeah.
We have an older brother that's left yesterday.
Connor Toulson will go on a mission for the Mormon Church this summer. His mother, Holly, has no doubts about the benefits of their religious background.
I believe that, you know, being on these basketball teams and these boys working together and helping one another, it does teach them a lot of life lessons, and they do learn how to integrate faith and sports together. It's kind of an interesting concept, but I think that their faith really has a lot to do with their success.
For this high school basketball season in America, one team sits alone at the top of the pack, Lone Peak. For Monocle, in Highland, Utah, I'm James Nelson.
Well, that was the very lovely voice of James Nelson on the joys of Mormon basketball.
Hongkong, Zürich, London. Das ist Monaco 24. Hongkong,
Hongkong,
Zürich,
London.
This is Monaco 24.
Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we find out why South Korea's central bank is on a spending spree for gold, and we check in with our Robert Bound from the Geneva Auto Show. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Andrew, thanks very much. Jordan is feeling the strain as official figures revealed over a million Syrians have now registered as refugees in neighbouring countries outside Syria. Jordan maintains an open border with Syria and has taken in over 400,000 refugees since the start of the conflict almost 2 years ago. Kenyan police have today said they found ballot papers dumped in some parts of the capital city, Nairobi. Police said the ballot papers were found in Nairobi's northern suburb of Ruaka, a stronghold of the presidential candidate Uhuru Kenyatta. A UNICEF report has said that Palestinian children, around 700, are detained by the Israeli military, subject to widespread systematic ill-treatment every year that violates international law. And the US Capitol was shut down today ahead of a predicted snowstorm that already has blanketed the Midwest, leaving thousands without power and forcing hundreds of flights in the United States to be cancelled. The government has ordered 375,000 federal workers in the Washington area to stay at home. And that's the latest news from Monaco 24.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. And Jonathan, thank you very much for the news headlines. We'll be having more in a moment. It's been the world's financial safe haven for decades, and I'm not talking about Swiss banks or even offshore accounts in the Cayman Islands. I'm talking about that precious metal, gold. Central banks around the globe have been filling their coffers with gold for decades. The United States Bullion Depository reportedly can hold up to 4,500 metric tons of the stuff. But while the United States has long been a good holder of gold, other countries such as South Korea and Kazakhstan are also on a buying spree too. Monocle's Phil Hahn caught up with Marcus Grubb, Managing Director of the World Gold Council, to find out why.
Bring us up to date with the latest news out of South Korea regarding buying up all this gold.
Yes, a number of central banks have been purchasing gold throughout 2012 and into the first part of 2013, of which South Korea is one of the banks that's been doing that. And with the recent purchases that South Korea made, they have risen up the rankings of central bank gold owners. They are now up to number 40 and continuing to move up the rankings. So, you know, they're not one of the major holders of gold, but for one of the smaller central banks, it is a significant increase in the amount of gold that they have. If you look at central bank holdings as a whole, they went up significantly last year, about 17%, with net purchasing of 535 tons, which was a record since the 1960s. And key among the buyers last year were Russia, Mexico, and Brazil.
So let's take a look at the Bank of Korea's buying decisions here. Last month, they added some 20 metric tons, or roughly they've increased their gold reserves by about 24%. Do we have a sense of why, what's behind this buying spree?
Yes, well, indeed, I think it's similar to the logic that's behind the other central bank purchases of gold, which is that as you have seen quantitative easing applied in OECD countries in order to moderate economic stagnation, a lot of emerging countries see this as a policy that will reduce the value of the dollar, reduce the value of the euro and other currencies using QE. And as a result, they are diversifying their central bank holdings of reserves away from these core currencies. And many of these countries have perhaps 40 to 50% of their foreign exchange reserves in US dollars. And they are diversifying into other asset classes, of which gold is one. And hence, there's a continuous increase and continuous rise in the percentage of gold in emerging country central bank portfolios. And this is happening in Latin America, in Central Asia, in the Far East as well. So I'd say South Korea in that sense is applying a similar policy that we're seeing from other central banks. It's diversification and it's protecting the assets that they have as part of their national reserves behind the currency. And the other thing to note is overall, if you look at Asian central banks, they tend to have pretty low weightings to gold on a global basis. In many cases, certainly below 5%, and in nearly all cases, below 10% of assets in physical gold. If you look across to Europe or to the United States, you see much higher gold weightings. So there's a natural tendency as well for emerging country central banks to add gold, especially if they're still building currency surpluses through exports. So we would anticipate that this activity will continue, and you'll see central banks in Asia, in Latin America, in the Far East continue to increase their weightings to gold.
So I just want to touch on that point. We know countries like the U.S. have vast gold reserves around the world. Other countries like France, I know, have quite a lot of gold in deposit. So is this a trend then that countries that don't normally buy as much gold, they're trying to, I guess, follow the American model, so to speak?
I think it's certainly the case that there is a dichotomy between, in a way, East and West, or certainly OECD countries and the rest of the world in terms of their gold buying habits. You know, at the moment, the Western central banks and Japan, U.S. are not purchasing gold, but neither are they selling it. And the history of this market is that for 15 to 20 years, those Western central banks and OECD central banks were sellers of gold. So what you've seen is that the OECD banks are no longer selling. They're simply holding on to the gold weightings that they have. And as the countries in Latin America, Asia, elsewhere have become wealthier in the last decade, they have been accumulating more gold. So that's pretty much what it is. And I think it's not so much following the U.S. model, because the U.S. model is different in that the dollar is the world's reserve currency. That and the euro are the two largest reserve currencies in the world, and the dollar is the largest of all. Therefore, you cannot hold currencies so easily behind the dollar as a strategic reserve, and hence the U.S. Treasury has, and the Federal Reserve have, the largest single weighting to gold in the world. It's over 8,100 tons, and roughly 75% to 76% of total reserves is in physical gold.
And I'm just having a look at the one-year chart for the price of gold, and it seems to me that right now we're pretty much at a one-year low, roughly, so to speak, give or take a few dollars. Is that also one of the reasons behind this buying spree?
It's true to say that certainly in 2012 and even in January, where we've had a number of new central banks enter the buying arena, Kazakhstan bought gold in January. We also saw some smaller Latin American countries buying in January. And last year, it was very much the case that central banks tended to come into the market when the price was in the lower end of the trading range that it's been in for a while. So I think, yes, that is a factor, but I think it's really more of a tactical factor. It just shows that central banks are smart buyers of gold.
And Marcus, gold has always been seen as a safe haven in during bad times, during bad economic times. We are seeing positive signs in the global economy that things are back on the up. But do you think that this is a signal that central bankers around the world think that this global recovery is still a lot less certain than we might expect?
Well, I think that's true, because central bankers around the world now are following policies in Western countries that are still designed to shore up the private economy through quantitative easing, notably in the United States with $85 billion a month. If that continues for the rest of the year, and I believe it's likely that it probably will, the Federal Reserve balance sheet will move up to $4 trillion by the end of 2013. Similar policies in the UK, in the Eurozone, and now in Japan with the election of the LDP in December, and now the new Bank of Japan governor coming in with new policies in March. You're going to see more reflation there. So, we don't see an end to these policies, and we think as a result, these central banks in countries that are not using these policies to reflate their economies, because they don't have to, are going to continue to be buyers of gold in order to protect their portfolios.
Well, that was Phil Hahn speaking to Marcus Grubb, who's Managing Director at the World Gold Council. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right after back after this quick break with a trip to the Geneva Motor Show. If we use, dear listeners, the metaphor of Monocle 24 as an online radio amusement park, then culture with me, Robert Bound, is the roller coaster.
We are finally on the train, on the sexy contemporary art train.
Scaling the heights of artistic endeavour to look out across a picturesque international landscape dotted with galleries, live music venues, outdoor screenings of wonderful movies being scrutinised and applauded by appreciative audiences. Marvel at the view. Strap yourself in. Scream, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go faster. We're just one metaphor away from a meltdown. On the latest edition, we ask how you export Saudi Arabian art. We go all the way to Ouagadougou just to watch films, and we hang out with that funk soul brother, Jamie Liddell.
I always wanted to live in Nashville because you can, you know, this is a place where you can do stuff, you can really create, and you don't get distractions.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre, and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental, it does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close, and there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's a review every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we head to the Geneva Motor Show. But to get us there, here's Gary Newman with Cars. Well, that was Cars by Gary Newman, and you're listening to Midori House. It's currently 18:44 here in London, and it's that time of year again when car junkies flock en masse to Switzerland for the annual Geneva Motor Show. And one person who's there is Mr. Robert Bound, who we've dispatched from Monocle's Midori House to report on the event for us. Rob, thank you for joining us. Now, these events, I know that they cover every category of car, but are you seeing any trends, any themes that we should know about?
I'm seeing a trend for short hemlines if you're a girl draped over a car. That's the first thing I've noticed. By the way, it's nice to be on the Andrew Tuck Show.
Welcome.
thank you. I think the trends are that luxury and performance are kind of two things that never seem to go out of fashion, especially at Geneva. There have been three kind of big launches from Lamborghini, from Ferrari and from Rolls-Royce, which are cars that add up to a total, I think, of £3 million or something if you added them all together. So it's kind of, there's a lot of this kind of thing. The European car market is all now about, seems to be about luxury rather than kind of making the runaround that you might be whizzing around back into from work on. And also, there's a kind of weird thing about, there's all these sorts of different delivery systems for fuel. It's no longer petrol. You're seen as a bit of a fuddy-duddy or a petrol head if you put petrol in your car. So a few of the marks have been making sort of headway into making all sorts of crazy kind of riffs on what you can fill up your tank with.
And tell me, you know, when we go to other kind of luxury events where you see that kind of luxury category of people, whether it's, you know, watches or art, everyone's got their eye on the Asian market and what the demands are for, you know, the rising economies such as Istanbul or whether it's, you know, Shanghai. Is there a sense that here, even though this is a European motor show, that people are still kind of wondering what's going on in those markets and how they can get their money there?
Yeah, and I think these markets, I mean, I think everyone is looking to these markets, China, Russia, and South America especially. I spoke to the new CEO of Rolls-Royce yesterday, in fact, and he was not shamelessly saying, well, we need to make these cars a little bit faster, a little bit sexier, less grand. They need to be the kind of car that you maybe don't have a chauffeur, you know, driving it, which is an important consideration for us all, Andrew, isn't it? Whether you really buy a car that needs a chauffeur or not.
Are we going to fire our chauffeur then?
Yeah, you can. It is possible to get in the front. I never knew this either, but apparently it is. But they're genuinely making considerations to reach into these new markets with slightly sexier, sporty cars. And as I said, you know, at the beginning, it seems to be all about performance and looks, and less about all the hybrid stories and the electronic and hydrogen and stuff that we were talking about a year or two ago, and I probably signed in for this show then. It seems to be the more European brands that are kind of trying to do that for the more savvy European, Scandinavian market.
And tell me, at the smaller end of the scale, you know, obviously that we often cover here in Monocle and on Monocle 24, the fact that, you know, lots of cities are kind of doing their damnedest to make driving a really miserable experience and trying to force you to get smaller and smaller cars. Is there much innovation in that market?
Yeah, I mean a sort of going great guns with this sort of thing. They've introduced their seventh at Geneva this year. They introduced their seventh addition to the Mini range. It used to be the good old Mini, and now there's seven of them. They've introduced a car called the Paceman, which is a kind of something that's a sort of Mini's take on an SUV. So of course it's teeny and it's quite sexy and it's quite muscular and it's got a wheel in each corner and it feels like a kind of go kart. So that's their kind of take on trying to make sort of city driving manageable. Nissan have launched a new Note and a new Leaf. The Leaf is their completely electric car, and the Note has got all this sort of different, all this kind of technology that makes sort of surviving in a city and urban driving easier. So it kind of, it's one thing away from a kind of park for you, Andrew, which is kind of neat. And we could do that sometimes in the Midori House. Not you, but sometimes we do that in the Midori House car park, a sort of self-parking car. There's all these things like tech and driver aids and all the rest of it are sort of being incorporated into these even quite basic models that are all kind of competing for this kind of super mini title.
Now, apart from chatting to some of the people who lie across the bonnets, can you just very quickly tell me before you go, is it fun?
It's hard work. It is fun. It's good fun. There's quite a lot of... It's quite... I don't want to use the word sausage fest, but there's a lot of blokes at it, and then a lot of models blokes on cars. There's fun to be found at the Palexpo come Geneva Motor Show. You just got to have an eye to find it, I think.
Good. Well, I'll be checking to see how many expenses you put in and who you took for dinner afterwards. I hope it's some nice gentleman from a nice stand rather than any person who was draping themselves, Mr. Bound.
It'll be a roller.
All right. Well, that was Robert Bound speaking to us from the Geneva Motor Show. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. London, an established capital of international trade, it hosts all manner of big global players when it comes to import and export. But one of the lesser known institutions that London hosts is the International Coffee Organization. The ICO is the closest thing that the coffee industry has to the United Nations. In fact, the structure is the same as the UN's, and the world body officially sanctions the ICO's activities. Over the suitably aromatic counter of the ICO's coffee bar, Monocle's David Pleasant talked to the high and mighty in the world of coffee about who's grinding and what's roasting.
Hello, my name is Mauricio Galindo. I'm the head of operations of the International Coffee Organization here in London.
And tell us what this event that we're about to go into right now is.
This is a seminar on trends in new coffee consuming markets. So basically, we have top analysts from all over the world who will be commenting on how consumption has picked up all over the world. We have people from Korea, we have Brazil, we have Russia, we have the American market in terms of the single serve. So all the new trends that are driving the market at the moment. Certainly a very important issue that has been raised here is the coffee leaf rust problem Central America is facing. They are ready to make a declaration probably tomorrow or on Thursday, and they will state that the loss is gigantic. They're thinking of something like 20 to 30% of the crop will be lost for the next probably 10 years. So the consequences socially and obviously from an economic point of view are gigantic. So they're making their plea here, and they're hoping that this organization can raise the voice from governments, from NGOs, from other UN bodies to get funds, to get technical support to deal with it.
And could you please explain the status of the ICO within the coffee industry? It's quite a special organization, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's an intergovernmental organization, which means it's made by governments who get together twice a year here in London to discuss all issues regarding consumption, production, trade barriers. Sometimes there's health issues, sometimes we have discussed protected geographical indications. So basically everything that relates to the trade, growth and consumption of coffee on a world scale. This is a forum for governments and private sector as well right now, which has been included recently, to discuss these very important matters that drive the industry.
And finally, if you could tell us, give us a tip off or something that most people wouldn't know, is there some kind of trend that we should be looking out for, something interesting that you're feeling or you've come across during meeting all these kind of important coffee dignitaries?
Well, I would say something very interesting is that a country like Russia is actually very interested in joining the organization. And one of the reasons the delegate has raised is that is because the United States has recently rejoined. And they, you know, politically they think that if the Americans are here, why would not they? So they are rejoining.
So Russian coffee drinkers, those are the people to watch.
It is. They are actually very excited about the prospects for consumption in Russia, yes.
My name is Saeki from Japan, All Japan Coffee Association.
And why do you come to this event here in London this week? What's the advantages for you?
Not to to say something, you know, or to study about, you know, the international movement, and also, you know, our experience would be helpful toward, you know, the ICO, you know, the movement, you know, we can do be of some help, you know. We are the now number 3 coffee importers among those in consuming countries. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as far as, you know, the amount of the volume is very big, you know, the consuming. So our experience from Asia is something very special and would be helpful for the ICO, yeah.
And what are the main concerns or what do you want to represent in terms of the Japanese coffee industry? What are the big issues at the moment for you?
Big issue for us is that, you know, the younger generation consumption amount is not so big, you know. The heavy user is middle and the, you know, the older age people. So, you know, we must make the younger more consume coffee, you know. Yeah.
And does that perhaps involve bringing new products, new types of coffee? Is that part of it as well?
Yes, you know, there is some, you know, the new type of coffee, you know, like you know, in Japan, you know, many type of drinks, you know. So the competition among those, you know, the drinks are very severe. And, you know, among those coffees, also there are many ways of drinking, you know, method, you know. So, for example, you know, the canned coffee drinks, you know, or liquid coffee, you know. Liquid coffee. For example, you know, liquid contained in the can or, you know, contained in the paper bag or contained in the poly bag, you know, and such a, you know, we call as a whole liquid coffee. This is something very special, you know, category of the coffee, you know. Yeah,
I'm Andrea Illy, and the chairman and CEO of Illy Cafe, and I'm chairing the promotion and market development committee here at the ICO. So I try to give my best possible contribution in promoting coffee consumption in the world.
What are the big issues for you? The forefront of European coffee production. What are the big issues?
Coffee was impacted in terms of volatility by both the economical crisis, which impacted consumption, as well as the volatility of the green coffee prices. So we need now a little bit of stabilization, a consolidation of the situation in order to continue to move ahead with the consumption.
My name is Harrison Kalua, and I represent the African Fine Coffee Association, an organization that's promoting the finest coffees from Africa. You know, this is an international coffee organization where all coffee players in the world meet to discuss issues, and we have come here to also to learn what is happening in other regions in this world, Latin America, you know, see what's happening, what makes the coffee movement their move. And from there, we should be able to see what we can articulate to make sure that we can also, articulate those things in our region. But at the same time, also to lobby in terms of what investments can come to Africa so that we can also, lift up the productivity of our industry in Africa. The dark cloud from Africa is moving away. You know, people were like, you're dealing with business people, you don't know whether what's happening. What's happening now is there are a lot of improvements in every sector. With the globalization now, the world is becoming one village. It's so easy, so you can do business everywhere without seeing any problem. You see the politics in Africa is improving, and there's a symptom that you don't have to be fear. You don't have to be afraid. You can go to Africa and source coffee. You can go to Africa and invest if you want to invest. I mean, that's the one place we have got land now. In the other continents, land is not a limiting factor. In Africa, we still have a lot of land, and so the labor is not as expensive. So you can come and invest, and you'll be assured of getting the support from our governments to make sure that Africa takes its rightful share in the coffee market.
That was David Pleasant's full-strength report from the International Coffee Organization here in London. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Phil Hahn, our researcher, Fernando Agosto Pacheco, and Annabelle Bly, and our studio manager, Ben Jay. Next up is The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove, who this week is looking at companies with a social focus, including a chat with a couple of authors who have both written books on the ethical business model.
The social entrepreneurs who I've come across, who are the really impressive ones, have seen that it's important to make some kind of profit in order to make your business sustainable.
In 3 hours' time at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson will be back with The Monocle Daily. Emma Nelson will also be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, goodbye.